All right, so we're learning the Epistle of James tonight. I anticipate that we will do about, and this is a rough estimate, but I anticipate that we will knock through James in about 12 lessons. My goal is to study James through the summer months, and then as we come into the high holidays, to be done with it. We certainly could study James a lot longer, but I think that's a reasonable target, is 12 lessons. Tonight we're just going to deal with the first verse, though. Yes?
Whoops.
Oh yeah, we have more handouts, yes?
The first verse?
Yeah, pretty much. Because I want to introduce James himself. I want to introduce James in the context and that sort of thing. And then we'll move more quickly. And I'm not saying that it's going to be a thorough study of James, because the wisdom of James, the writings of James, are very much like the teachings of his more famous brother, that have you don't get to the bottom of it quickly. There's a lot here. It's densely packed, and so we'll do better if we learn more of an overview of what James is doing and how he thinks and how he writes, and then we can take those skills home with us and learn James on our own. But tonight we're mostly going to just talk about James himself, because our salutation is James, a servant of God and of the Master, Yeshua the Messiah, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, or in the diaspora, you could translate that. Yeah. Greetings. All right. So this is the first verse, and he introduces himself not as James, the brother of the Master, but rather he introduces himself as James, a servant of God. So this has led people to wonder, how do we know? How do we know who's writing here? How do we know who this James is? But, you know, because there's other Jameses. There's James the son of Zebedee, James the Big. But he was martyred very early on, and there's James the son of Alphaeus. He's an obscure character, James the Less. The thing is that there's so many Jameses that there's really only one James who can get away with just saying James, and that would be James, the brother of the Master. But he does have some other epithets that go with his name. He is called Brother of the Master. Here he refers to himself as a servant of God and of the Master, Yeshua the Messiah. So I want to talk about his relationship as a brother, though, even though that's not mentioned here, because that's interesting. How is it that the Son of God has a brother? That's what allegedly the guy who found the James ossuary, when he had an Aramaic scholar come in and translate it, and the scholar said, you know, this purports to be James, the brother of Yeshua, the brother of Jesus. So allegedly this guy replied, how can the Son of God have a brother? You know what? He'd never heard of this. Anyway, so let's look at this text in Matthew 13, which gives us the names of the brothers, the brothers of the Master. Matthew chapter 13, 55, where they say in Nazareth, and this is the Master's hometown, they say, is this not the carpenter's son? So is this not Joseph the carpenter's son? And then they say, is not his mother called Mary? That's Miriam. And his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas. Now, these lists are almost always a birth order list, a list like that, when you have a list of brothers. It's almost always going to be a birth order. So we're talking about James the oldest, and then on down the line. James, that's Yaakov in Hebrew. Yaakov or Jacob. And then Joseph. That would be, he's called Yossi in another text, Joses, which is short for Joseph. He's named after his father. And Simon is Shimon. And Judas is Yehuda, or Jude for short. Yehuda. So there's three theories about... Oh, and then there's the sisters. I wish they would give us the sisters' names. I really wish they were there. But there's a tradition on the sisters that the sisters are named Miriam and Shalamet, or Salome. Miriam and Salome. Which is very likely, since those are the ranking number one and number two popular Jewish girls' names of the first century, for first century Palestinian Jews. Miriam and Salome, because they're both Hasmonean names. It's very popular. Shalamet, Shalom Tzion, that's named after Queen Salome. Anyway, how can the Son of God have brothers? This is the question. So there are three theories. You may or may not be aware of this, but there are three primary theories to explain this phenomenon. Thank you for bringing up the extra tables and chairs. Yeah. Three theories. So the first one is called the Epiphanian theory, because Epiphanius of Salamis, he's the one who articulated this theory, but he didn't make it up. It's a really early church tradition, and it's the one favored by the Eastern Orthodox. So Epiphanius explains, the situation was that Joseph had children from a previous marriage, and his first wife died before he married Miriam, the mother of the master. And so these brothers and sisters of Yeshua are actually older stepbrothers and stepsisters. Okay? So that's, well, this is a very old tradition. You see, the advantage to this is it allows us to retain the perpetual virginity of Mary, because according to early Christian legend, Mary remained a virgin forever and ever. You might think, well, not forever. Yeah, you might think, not forever. I mean, but no, forever. Forever. So you might think, well, but she had the baby. But no, the baby teleported out of her womb. So, I mean, well, that's the tradition. That the birth of the master via teleportation. So this the Epiphanian theory allows us to retain the virginity, the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Hieronymian theory, which is favored by the Roman Church, the Western Church, has a little bit of a variation on this. Are we out of handouts? Because I can print more if we need more.
So good for right now.
Okay. All right. So the Roman Catholics taught this that Yeshua's siblings were actually cousins. Cousins, the children of Clopas, which was Joseph's brother, but raised in the family of the master. All right, and there again, that allows us to retain the virginity of Mary. There's the Protestant theory, and I would call this the Jewish theory, because in Jewish sources we don't see this sort of thing, and we don't see this sort of thing, this idea of a perpetual virginity and that sort of thing. We don't find it in biblical sources or anything like that. Instead, the Bible just presents it as the brothers of Jesus, and always pairs the brothers of Yeshua with Mary, and so you have the association that these are her children. And so according to this theory, just like it says in the gospel, Joseph took her as his wife, would mean that he seriously took her as his wife and had more children after the birth of the master. So that's the one that I prefer, even though it does not have a strong tradition behind it. It seems like the simplest answer. It introduces the least complexity. Of these brothers of the master, we really only know about we only know information about two of them, James and Jude, and we don't know much about Jude except that he wrote an epistle, and he had some sons. and they had some sons, and they got arrested by Domitian. But that's another story. All right.
That's another study.
Any sisters?
Yeah, the master has two sisters. The sisters are Shalom Tzion, or just Shalamit, and Miriam, according to tradition. A reasonable tradition. Possible there are more than two sisters, but we have to have at least two sisters. It's very possible there's more than two. So you probably heard my theory before about why the master doesn't begin his ministry until the age of 36 or so. No, some of you, yes, some of you, no. Well, just very simply, we believe that Joseph, his father, dies around the age of probably when he's in early teen. The last time we see him is when the master is 12 years old. So that would leave Yeshua as head of household. And so he's going to be raising this family and responsible for this family until they're all grown up and married off. And so then at probably around the age of 33, 34, something like that, he is free of that obligation, except towards his mother, which he discharges to John at his death. So I love to see the family of the Master. I love little glimpses into the family of the Master in Nazareth. And so it was very exciting for us in 2002. Remember when the James Ossuary was found? Big news. Big archaeological news that this ossuary, it's a bone box, shows up on the antiquities market, and the inscription on it says Yaakov Bar Yosef Ahui de Yeshua, which is Aramaic for James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. Okay? Now, the excitement is short-lived because then the IAA comes in and says, it's a fake, it's a forgery. And that's pretty much where the world has left it. However, not all scholars agree with the IAA's assessment, because the IAA's assessment of the James Ossuary happened to come at a time when they were cracking down on unprovinced archaeological finds. And they declared tons of stuff forgeries. I mean, stuff that's been in museums for years, just on the basis that, well, it seems, just on the basis that it wasn't found by an archaeologist, it was bought off the antiquities market. Well, archaeological relics are found on the antiquities market all the time. All the time. So what's the primary objection to the authenticity of the bone box of James? Number one, too good to be true. If something's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. But beyond that, the primary objection, there's been scholars back and forth about the patina on the box and whether it was scrubbed or whether, you know, if it's old enough. Everyone agrees it's a first century bone box. Everyone agrees with that. Everyone agrees that the inscription, James the son of Joseph, is legitimate. That's from the first century. The question is the words, brother of Yeshua. And the primary suspicion cast on the words, brother of Yeshua, is that they are incised on the box in a different handwriting than the original. All right, so I can accept that because it seems very natural to me that you could easily have a second generation or somebody going back in even at a later time, because you're constantly reopening these tombs, filling bone boxes, moving boxes around. These tombs are in constant use. You could easily see someone, especially, you know, a Jewish believer or more likely even a family member that wanted to venerate and remember which box belonged to James, adding those words at a later time. So I don't see that as a strike against it. And Gabi Barkai, who is the most eminent archaeologist in Israel and in Jerusalem, believes it's authentic. Gabi Barkai. So, I don't know. I don't see why we got to doubt everything. You know, does it make any difference? No, it doesn't make any difference, but it's cool. All right. when James, we first meet James, you know, in John chapter 7, not a believer. It says, all, you know, of all the, even his own brothers were not believing in him, back in John chapter 7. But when we come to the end of the ministry, apparently the brothers have, something's happened. They've had a change of heart. They've had a change of mind. And so remember from the Messiah banquet, when we I read that text from the Gospel of the Hebrews about the Master's appearance to James. And so by then, by the time of the resurrection, James and probably the other brothers as well have become convinced. And they are, they have become followers. So that's a transition, if that's correct. That transition happened within 6 months. Because that story of Sukkot in John chapter 7, where it says even his own brothers were not believing in him, that is Sukkot, right? As he's going, they're saying, why don't you go up to Sukkot? And that's just 6 months before the last Passover. So something happens in those last 6 months. Perhaps the crucifixion itself, I don't know, or something, to change their thinking about their brother. So I want to give you a character sketch of James based on the writings of Hegesippus really quickly. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. This is the martyrdom of James. I will not read you the whole thing, just read you the first part. Hegesippus was apparently a 2nd century Jewish Christian who was carrying, he had a wealth of early apostolic lore with him. And so he writes this, he says, control of the church passed to the apostles, together with the master's brother James, whom everyone from the master's time till our own has called the righteous. So this is the epithet, Hatzadik. There is a guy in Judaism that carries the same epithet, Shimon HaTzadik. You may be recognized from Pirkei Avot, Simon the Righteous. So here, it's not unheard of. For there were many Jameses. It's one of the most popular names. But this one was holy from his birth. He drank no wine or intoxicating liquor and ate no animal food, nor razor came near his head. He did not smear himself with oil and took no baths. Yes. James the Righteous. They had other names for him too. No. I understand this to mean he didn't go to bathhouses.
That's, yeah, he took mikvahs.
Yeah, he's taking mikvahs on a daily basis, as we'll see. But what it means is he didn't go to the bathhouses. There were some sages that approved of the bathhouses because they liked them, like Hillel, for example. And then there were some sages who did not approve of the bathhouses. And Hillel was kind of the one who broke the ground on that and shocked his disciples. And they followed him to the bathhouse. And they're like, what were you doing in there? You know, it was a Roman thing. Bathhouses, going in there, all these naked people everywhere. You know, it doesn't work for Jewish sensibilities. Okay, so he took no baths. He alone was permitted to enter the holy place, for his garments were not of wool, but of linen. So according to Hegesippus, James had some sort of privilege with the Levitical establishment, which might have something to, I don't know, I mean, it's hard to even guess at what that would mean. He used to enter the sanctuary and was often found on his knees beseeching forgiveness for the people, so that his knees grew hard like a camel's from his continually bending them in worship of God and beseeching forgiveness for the people. Because of his unsurpassable righteousness, he was called the righteous and oblius in our own language, bulwark of the people and righteousness, fulfilling the declarations of the prophets regarding him. This is a frustrating passage because, first of all, oblius is not a word. We don't know what that means. So it's probably a manuscript error when you have a Greek copyist who's like trying to copy a transliteration. You know how crazy transliterations get. So it's a miscopy of a transliteration. We don't know what the original was. We have no idea. And he makes a reference to the prophets, but he doesn't tell us what the reference is. Anyway, great passage, great story, martyrdom of James. He's the head over the church. He's the head over the believers. The head over the apostles. The apostles answer to James. Even the 12, even Peter, to whom the master said, I give you the keys to the car and the authority over the kingdom, right? To bind and to loose. They answer to James because James occupies the place of Jesus. He's the successor, so to speak. I mean, that's crazy talk to think of it like that. To think like, what? Jesus has a successor? Yes. He had a successor, and it's James, his brother. Now, in what sense is he the successor? He's not like the next son of God or something like this. God's second son. Right. But rather, he is the steward. Remember, we learned about this when we were studying Galatians, the early sermons on Galatians. He's the steward that holds the throne of the master. In the ancient world, when a king was away, he would leave a steward in charge of his throne. The steward acted as king in the king's absence. And he had all the authority of the king because the king had given him his ring and his and so on to discharge his authority for him. But as soon as the king returned, the steward would step aside and the king would return to his throne. So the steward has got to be someone that the king can really trust, you know, someone that he can entrust his authority with and that he knows isn't going to lead a revolution or something. So James is occupying that kind of role.
Did he have that because of the sibling relationship?
Yes.
It was the sibling dynamic.
It's two things. The sibling dynamic, but also his righteousness. Right. Mm-hmm. So the sibling dynamic, we know because we'll see the same thing happen with other successors to the throne, that they're all from the same family. They're from... Not from the nuclear family there, but they're all from this Davidic clan that lives up in the Galilee. So the next one after James, I've got the bishop's list here. I'll read you the bishop's list.
None of them called Schneerson, are they?
No, but I mean that's a good example. What you're talking about is a good example. Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, had roots that went back to the Davidic house. Which made him qualified, perhaps, to be the Mashiach, but also, you know, gave him a certain amount of swagger. In terms of authority. So too with all the patriarchate: Hillel, a descendant of David; Gamliel, a descendant of David; Shimon ben Gamliel, and so on, all the way through to Judah Hanasi, who even he can claim some Davidic ancestry on his mother's side. Same thing with the exilarch, the head over the Jewish community in Babylon, also traces his house back to David. So the idea of Davidic having a share of a Davidic authority is important. This is a little piece of information for you from Eusebius, Ecclesiastical History. But the idea is that all these bishops, the first 15 bishops over Jerusalem, first 15 patriarchs, you might say, over Jerusalem, were all from this family of the master's brothers and cousins. And they're called the Desposini. They refer to themselves as the Desposini, which means the master's people. I just ordered a book yesterday by this renegade Catholic priest who claims that he makes some claims about the Desposini still trying to get power back from Rome in the 4th century, which is possible. I'll see what he has to say when the book comes. Yeah, so you had these bishops over Jerusalem up until, and this is, you know, this has happened up until the Bar Kokhba revolt, and then under the Bar Kokhba revolt, we lost our footing in Jerusalem, and Then it passes when all the Jews are exiled from Jerusalem after the Bar Kokhba revolt. And so it passes to a guy named Marcus, and he's the first Gentile bishop, and that it's all over after that. But I mean, if we had the opportunity, I mean, you know how we have problems and questions and we don't know what to do and that sort of thing, or like have disagreements and maybe theological battles and this sort of thing. If this was in place, we could simply send, we'll take two guys, we'll say, you two guys, we'll take these two right here. Beth Emmanuel's going to pay for your airfare to Israel. You're going to go to Jerusalem. You're going to go up to the house, and you're going to present our question, and they'll give us a ruling, and they'll give us an answer, come back, and whatever they said, that's it. It's you know, that's it. That's law. That's the way it was. And so that's how we say, you know, we see even, you know, Paul is having to answer to James, and you know.
So James was the first bishop, so this is like a ruling system, Jerusalem above the Sanhedrin.
Here's why I wouldn't put it that way, because James and the apostles are not dealing with the kinds of national questions that the Sanhedrin is dealing with. They're not dealing with a question of, for example. Shall we continue to sanction the priesthood to offer a sacrifice on behalf of Caesar? You know, big political questions. They're not dealing with that. Neither are they dealing with minute halakhic questions like the Sanhedrin would be dealing with. Calendar issues. They're not dealing with any of that sort of thing. They're not like setting the calendar, figuring out the new moon or anything like that. Because that authority is already there. It's already in place. They represent the monarchy. You see, you always had monarchy and judicial system. Okay? Just like we have president and our court system and our legislature. Okay? The Sanhedrin is like the legislature and judicial system. The king is like the high judge. The disciples of the master are not told, you will sit on 70 seats adjudicating over the 12 tribes of Israel. They're told, you will sit on 12 thrones. And so they are representatives of the king. So this is how they see themselves, and this is how James sees himself. He doesn't see himself as, you know, like as if he's in competition with the Sanhedrin. They have a different sphere of authority. Now, occasionally those are going to cross, and you're going to have some fireworks and that sort of thing. Anyway, regardless of which apostle, all the apostles should answer to what we could call the Jerusalem See, or the Jerusalem Vatican, if you prefer. I was going to talk about this name, James the Righteous, Yaakov HaTzadik. So, to be a righteous person, you know, a sinless person, or a nearly sinless person, or so righteous that he seems like he's sinless, or so righteous that compared to me, he's sinless. You know, that's all those things would apply to someone who is called righteous. It doesn't mean necessarily sinless. It means someone who's upright and walking in Torah and keeping the commandments and so forth. So Hegesippus, as I read, said, everyone from the master's time till our own, which is mid-second century, has called him the righteous. Josephus writes, he was the most righteous of men. Josephus, not a believer, is a secular historian. In the apocryphal gospel of Thomas, we have this great passage. The disciples said to Yeshua, we know that you are going to leave us. Who will be our leader? Yeshua said to them, no matter where you are to go to James the righteous, James the just, for whose sake heaven and earth came into being. If that seems a little crazy, that heaven and earth came into being just for the sake of James the Just, just understand that's a Jewish way of speaking. And I'll, for example, in Yoma 38b, Rabbi Eliezer said, even for the sake of a single tzaddik, a single righteous man, would this world have been created. And in Sanhedrin 98b, Rav said, the world was created for David's sake. Shmuel said, for Moses' sake. Yochanan said, for the sake of Messiah. So it's an idiom to say he's really important. He's a really important guy. All right, so that's my brief character sketch of James. He dies in 62. That's a whole other story. His death is narrated in two different versions, one by Hegesippus and one by Josephus. They can probably be harmonized, reconciled to each other. Any questions on James?
So who was he answering to?
Who is James answering?
Who did James answer to? If he was a bishop, he mm-hmm. wasn't a king. He was a bishop.
Right.
And then there was a king that he answered to?
King Jesus.
King Jesus, yeah. Who had resurrected.
Yeah.
Okay, so he had this. So he was the ultimate authority in Jerusalem.
James is the ultimate. Well, Jesus is the ultimate authority in Jerusalem. Yeah, but I mean, there's an interim period here where we're waiting for Messiah to take his throne. So it's a tentative authority that he hasn't quite stepped into yet. And the apostles are waiting for that. So James is like keeping the position warm, so to speak.
Being a steward, like
right. Yeah, so he's been a steward over the assembly of the master until the master returns. Yeah.
Why did their line die off?
That's a great question.
Because you said up into the 4th century, so there's a radical out there, a Roman guy, who's saying that up into the 4th century they were still around.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that's true for halakhic believers as well,
mm-hmm.
up until around the 4th mm-hmm. century. And we don't know why they disappeared then.
Well, they were small in number. I'm sure by the 4th century they were really small in number. And I think there were two things that had happened that account for the disappearance of Jewish believers in general, and the same principle would apply to these guys, to the Despoteni. Two things were happening. One was the incredible wild success of Gentile Christianity, which had a very, you know, it was attractive. There was an allure there. You know, it's like we could be part of this, you know. But as soon as Jews became part of Gentile Christianity, they lost their Jewishness, of course, and then that was gone in a generation, like we've discussed in Galatians. Then, on the other side, was just greater Jewish culture. If you're living as a halakhic Jew, you're living as an observant Jew, as Epiphanius says, the Jewish believers, the only difference between them and the rest of Jewry was their confession of Messiah. So they're living as observant Jews. It's very difficult to maintain that separate identity in the midst of the much larger Jewish community. So, for example, we've known a lot of Jewish believers who are part of the Jewish community, and they say we feel called to the larger Jewish community, to stay in the larger Jewish community, and that's a great thing. We endorse that. But the question is always, your children are going to have the same calling, you know? They're going to have that same sense of, we're just a little bit different. So I think that assimilation in two directions. We see that same tug happening on people here all the time, don't we? I mean, it's like, boom, gone, boom, gone. One direction, one the other direction. It's like, you know? So I think when you're small, you're disenfranchised, you're persecuted, and there's two gigantic magnetic religions who are trying to suck you up, it's very hard to remain. That's encouraging. the reason that James dies, I believe it's Hegesippus who makes a statement. Under the influence of James, you know, more and more people were going over to the opinion of the Pharisees that believed in the resurrection. So they decided that they had to get rid of him. And so they throw James down from the parapet of the temple. This is probably the same place, interesting, that the master stood when the devil tempted him and said, throw yourself down and your foot won't strike against the stone. So they throw James down from there at Passover time. And he survives the fall, miraculously survives the fall, just like it says, your foot wouldn't strike against a stone, the angels would bear you up in their palms. He survives the fall. This is what the legend says. He survives the fall, and so then they stone him once he gets down to the ground. And
how far is it that he fell?
Well, Josephus says, if you stood on the pinnacle of the temple and look down into the Kidron Valley. And by pinnacle of the temple, it means the corner, the southeast corner of the royal stoa. And you're looking down then into the Kidron Valley. It was so far down you couldn't see the bottom. Well, that's an exaggeration. I mean, for sure that's an exaggeration, but it's really, really, really a long ways down. Should not survive the fall. And if the devil's going to tempt you to jump off somewhere and survive, we're not talking about 30 feet, you know. Okay, so I want to deal with this first verse, his salutation. He says, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. And I would, if I was translating this, I would say to the 12 tribes in the diaspora, because that's the word we use. That's how we use it. Diaspora refers specifically to Jewish people living outside of the land of Israel. That's what diaspora is. Now, the word has come to be used in different contexts, like we speak of the African diaspora now. Originally, Jews were the only people who got a diaspora. Now we're applying it more broadly because the concept works. But the Jewish people have this connection to the land. They feel, and they have these prophecies about being scattered all over the earth and then someday being gathered back to the land. And that's why diaspora has, you know, it carries that strength, carries that weight. So the question is, what do we mean when he addresses this to the 12 tribes in the diaspora? Because, hey, weren't 10 tribes lost? Like, where did we put them? Ever since the days of the Assyrian exile, 10 of the 12 tribes have been in exile, and they are lost, and nobody knows who they are or where they are, and so on. So because of that, there's some different explanations. Bible commentaries in the past and preachers have often said when he says 12 tribes in the diaspora or in the dispersion, that's just symbolic talk. What he means is the church. That's like calling the church the new Israel and so on. So he means Christians in general. Nobody accepts that anymore. That's I don't know any scholars that would hold on to that position anymore, because even if you were a replacement theology guy, this is not a way that you talk about Gentile Christians at all. You don't call them 12 tribes, and you don't call them in diaspora. It only makes sense to talk like this about Jews. So the next theory is to say, well, it's just sort of a poetic name for Jewry in general. You know, to the 12 tribes, and what I really mean is just, you know, Jews, right? And that's almost correct. And in fact, I think you could say that. However, there's one more option, and Richard Bauckham, who's my favorite scholar, says we really should just take it literally. He means to the 12 tribes, because in the first century, the 10 tribes weren't lost yet, which is pretty remarkable. But then he brings like information saying they're in Media, they're in Persia. He has citations on this. Says they were in Adiabin, Iran, Iraq. The communities are still known about. They're still in contact with Jerusalem. We have certain sages with names like the Mede who have, and they're still paying temple tax. They're paying their half shekel temple tax. So how did they get lost? If we knew where they were in the first century, how did we lose them since then?
And who are the two tribes that are not lost?
Oh, the two tribes that are not lost are Judah mm-hmm. and Benjamin. Because Judah had control of Benjamin, and so when the 10 tribes went into exile, Benjamin fell under the domain of Judah. You know, Jerusalem sits in the territory of Benjamin.
How does Levi fit into
that? Levi is like the odd tribe out. We don't count them when we talk about tribes. Levi, you always have Levies. You had Levies in the north, you had Levies in the south. So this is something that we're always seeing on these, is like is this little people group here, they have some Jewish customs and that sort of thing? Possibly. But more likely, the situation is that in the ancient world, you didn't make distinctions like that if you were a non-Jew. Everybody that practiced that religion was called a Jew, regardless of if you were of the tribe of this or the tribe of that. And so Paul can refer to himself as a Jew, a Hebrew from the tribe of Benjamin, right?
What's her name in Anna?
Oh,
she's from?
Anna is from Asher in the New Testament. So what happened, here's my theory of the lost tribes. I think they got lost inside Judaism. And that, you know, this designation, Jew, the Jewish people, now encompasses, you know, all 12 tribes are lost in there, in the mix. And I'm not saying there's not some remote people groups here and there and here and there that might also have ancestry. But for the most part, I think the Jewish people are the 12 tribes. The reason, the word Judaism just simply means the religion that was practiced in Judea during the Roman period. It's that's the way we would probably derive that.
But the Jews are from all 12 tribes, not just from the tribe of Judah.
Yes, yes.
So they're all the descendants of Jacob?
Yes, this is what I'm arguing, that people who are called Jews are descendants of all 12 tribes. You can't really know, unless they have some sort of genealogical evidence themselves within their own family, you don't really know what tribe they're coming from. So the priests obviously are coming from Levi, someone who identifies himself as a Levi is coming from Levi, but beyond that, it's pretty unlikely that someone would know their tribal identity anymore, unless they had been of the Davidic family, and therefore they're keeping that, they have that tradition that we are Davidic, then you know that's they're from the tribe of Judah. Okay, why is this so important? Here's why it's so important. As he writes, he says, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. And now we assume that if you are James, brother of the Master, what you really mean is to the Jewish believers who are scattered abroad, greetings. But instead, he doesn't say to the Christians or to the disciples or anything. He says to the 12 tribes. He addresses his epistle to all Israel living in the diaspora. This makes sense because he's in Jerusalem. And what do we see, the Jerusalem church is, they're in charge. You have all the churches report to them. We go to them. If we're living out here in Hudson and we have a question, we're going to go to James in Jerusalem. So James now sends a letter. He says, you know what, I'm going to send a letter to everybody living outside of Jerusalem. But why doesn't he address it just to believers? And the reason is, Messiah is not just the Messiah of believers. This is kind of a big thought, but in terms of Israel, he's not just the Savior, not just the Messiah of Jewish believers and Jewish disciples of him, but rather he's the king of all Israel. He's the king of Israel. So if James is holding the throne, so to speak, he's the steward in his brother's place, he sees his authority as extending to all Israel, not just to believers. This is a first century way of thinking. It's really hard for us because we're so used to, like, well, there's us and there's them, you know, that separation. But from the apostolic point of view, I mean, they were like, we're going to sit on 12 thrones over all Israel, not we're going to sit on 12 thrones over people who believe in Jesus.
So that includes Jews and Gentiles.
That would include everyone.
Indeed, Yeshua.
What?
No.
I'm saying that James believes that he has something to say and authority to say it to all Jewish people, whether they believe in his brother or not.
Oh.
Because his brother is the Messiah, and it's just a matter of time until everybody's going to know it. So he takes that kind of authority. And so the apostles, they see themselves, they see this messianic movement within greater Judaism, not as a, you know, we always talk about a sect. That's what they're labeled. But they never call themselves a sect. They never say, we are the sect of believers in Yeshua. They don't think of themselves as a sect. They think of themselves more as a center. Like, you know, the guys on the Sanhedrin didn't think of themselves as a sect. They thought of themselves as in charge. And we find the same with the apostles, with the disciples. They represent the monarch. They represent the monarchy. If anything, they're there to revitalize all of Judaism, all Jewish people, and to bring them this revelation of good news, repent, and enter the Messianic era. Repent because we've discovered the Messiah. But not as a sect, not as a something else, other than type of thing, a separate movement.
Were they in competition for that thinking and that position with others who were of the belief that they were of the Messiah?
And mm-hmm. My understanding is that there were...
Other Davidics, perhaps. Other Davidic authorities, okay. Maybe. Everyone's in competition. I would say there's an ideological war going on in the first century, especially after the destruction of the temple. Everybody's in competition. Everybody wants. It's like there's all sorts of human beings all over, and they all think that they're in charge. So yes, but this is. I would say they're definitely in competition with the Sadducees. They think the Sadducees should be. They're the wicked tenants over the vineyard that killed the son and should be thrown out and replaced by new authorities, which should be them. So, yes, in competition. Okay. Whenever we study something, I always teach you, there's certain questions we ask when we come to a piece of literature. There's who wrote it? To whom did he write it? When did he write it? What is it? Why did he write it? Okay, so we'll just run through these things. So far we've worked on the who wrote it. And we got that. To whom did he write it? We worked on that. He writes it to all Jews living in diaspora. Now this is curious. This makes it doesn't belong to Gentiles. The Epistle of James. Doesn't mean it doesn't speak to us.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that it doesn't speak to us. It certainly does, because actually it's just, as we'll discuss in a minute, it's just wisdom literature that has a universal meaning. However, it was not addressed. James was not addressing it to Gentiles. Just like Paul's letters, not addressed to exclusively Jewish believers. So, you know, we just see that there's differentiation. When you address a letter to someone, it's to them, right?
Is the distinction that it's the ones in the diaspora and not the ones
yes.
in the land?
Yes, excellent, excellent. Also not written to Jews living within the land of Israel. I don't know what difference that would make, but it's not. I think I'll make a case for why I think that's relevant in just 2 minutes. Okay, so who is it written to all Jews living in diaspora? But I say primarily believers, because in reality, who's going to read it and respect it? You know, so the guy thinks he's Prince Charming. You know, he thinks he's holding down the throne of King David. Why should I care if I'm not a believer in Yeshua? If you're a believer in Yeshua, then yes, absolutely. This is from the brother of the master. You know, it's a big deal. Okay. When is it written? Well, it has to be written between 50 Common Era, which is 20 years after the resurrection, and 62 Common Era. On the front end, I say 50 Common Era because it references some Pauline thought and brings correction to it. And so it can't be written, I don't think, earlier than those Pauline epistles. And the first Pauline epistle, Galatians, is around, we would date around 49. So I'm saying 50 on the earliest, 62 on the latest. Why 62 on the latest? Because that's when James is killed. So you've got about a 12-year window. What is it? It's an epistle, obviously. It's a letter. An epistle is a letter. But it's not like an epistle like the epistles of Paul, where you're dealing with specific people with specific problems in a specific place. This epistle is addressed to all Jews living outside the land of Israel. So we have to keep it pretty general. It's like an open letter. You know what an open letter is? It's like when you expect everybody to read it, you know, you post an open letter for everybody to read. In that sense, it's similar to other encyclical types of things that are put out by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin might send out an open letter to everyone, saying, we've ruled that the new moon this year is, you know, was such and such, therefore Rosh Hashanah is going to be at such and such, and Yom Kippur on such and such, you know. Open letter like that. In addition to being an epistle, James is wisdom literature. And this is really important, maybe the most important point to understand. Because we'll have to, as we study this over the next 12 weeks or whatever, we're going to want to understand what wisdom is, what it means, and what he means, because he talks about wisdom quite a bit. Wisdom literature is a category of Jewish literature. It starts with, like, the book of Proverbs. What is the book of Proverbs? It's wisdom. Good advice. Exactly. It's good advice. And things that are true, things that are deep and true and that provide a moral course, you know, like a course, a direction, a rudder, steering wheel for life, moral guidelines, boundaries. There's a lot of if and then equations. If you're an idiot, you'll do stupid things. That's wisdom, you know? A lot of profundities, maxims and aphorisms and sayings. Okay, so that's what the book of Proverbs is. When were we talking about this just recently? Yeah. I was in the conference about how the king of Israel was known for his wisdom. So King Solomon, you know, is known for his wisdom. Proverbs are his wisdom. People come up from all over the world to hear the wisdom of the king of Israel because he's, you know, he's the king. He's God's representative on earth. He's the wisest man in the world, the king of Israel. So Hezekiah, you know, his proverbs are in our collection as well. So you have this genre then that's inspired by that that's we call wisdom literature, and it's a very different kind of Jewish writing. It's not we have different genres of Jewish writing. We have apocalypses like the Book of Revelation. What's an apocalypse? Here's an apocalypse. I was walking along and I saw an angel and he said, come up here. And then he took me on a tour of heaven and I saw all sorts of wild hallucinogenic stuff. And there were battles and there was good and there was evil and the end times came. That's an apocalypse. Dime a dozen. We've got, prophetic works. What's a prophetic work? Prophet says, thus says the Lord, such and such and such and such and so and so and so and so, and God said this, and that's a work of prophecy. We have the Psalms, you know, liturgical works. What are liturgical works? They're like, you know, praise the Lord, all ye peoples, right? And we have historical works. It happened, it came to pass on this, you know.
What would you call Paul's letters?
Personal mail. Yeah. They don't fall into any of those categories. They are seriously personal mail, but are they? So moving into rabbinic categories, we have Haggadic works, That's like the teachings of the master. A man had two sons, parables and that sort of thing. We have halakhic works. That's like the Mishnah, the Tosefta, the Talmud. The Talmud has everything in it. But that's just legal disputations. And, how many cobs of water does it take to fill a mikvah, and so on. Letters of Paul, really, they're pastoral, and they don't fall in. I can't think of a rabbinic category that they fall into.
You can't think of a genre that you put.
No, I can't. But James falls into a genre that we call wisdom. Wisdom literature.
Are you about to say why you call it wisdom?
Well, because it's a string of aphorisms, proverbs, sayings, moral guidances, that sort of thing, and not addressing any particular, like, this is your situation, let me speak directly to that situation, but rather these are principles for life, application, that could apply to anyone in any place at any time. There's a book very similar, and we can find a lot of crossover between it, and that is the book of Ben Sira, Yeshua, the wisdom of Yeshua Ben Sira, Jesus Ben Sirach.
Before or after James?
Well, before James, before Yeshua. Yeshua, our master, alludes to it several times at points, seems to quote it even in, or paraphrase it. And James also, and it reads very much like the book of Proverbs. So I'll bring that along next week, and we'll look at some examples of. But here's the important thing: I want you to just have this idea that I think, okay, what do we put Paul's epistles into? If anything, if the teaching of Yeshua and the teaching of the apostles. Could all, if we say, what kind of rabbis were they? They were wisdom rabbis. They're more in the world of Pirkei Avot, than any other tractate of the Mishnah. Whereas Pirkei Avot is the teachings of the fathers, sayings of the fathers.
You might put them in
Musar. Yeah, Musar that's the right word. That's the right word. So Musar means instruction, ethical instruction. Okay? That's a Hebrew word. You would want to, if you had to say what kind of literature is the New Testament, it's not halakhic. It's not really haggadic, because it's not just parables. It's musar. It's instructional. It's how you live life. That's the kind of rabbis they were, and that's the kind of epistle that James is sending out. That's how he's. And why is that? Because that was the teaching of Yeshua. That's where, and so James is responsible. What we're going to find is that James is, even though he never actually seems to quote Yeshua, can you imagine that? Not once? Maybe he does. We'll see. Nevertheless, he's repackaging Yeshua's words, reformulating them in his aphorisms, his little sayings, over and over and over again. So he's transmitting the teaching of his brother out to the diaspora. All right. Why is it written? Why was this written? There's two occasions here that I'm going to. The first one, it seems artificial. I think the second one is where it's really at. The first one is, we see that he starts off with, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." And he talks about persecution, testing, and trial for this first chapter. And so perhaps there is a persecution that's happening, and he wants to write out, he wants to write an epistle to encourage people. Well, we know there's always persecutions going on in the first century. And in the second century, the third century, persecutions all the time. Could be. That could be. But I think more to the point, is what he says in chapter 2, beginning in 14, where he starts his grace, or his works versus faith, faith versus works discussion. And this makes sense to me, because where was Paul working? Where did he do all of his work? Out in diaspora. Out in the diaspora synagogues. He's out there teaching, raising a following, raising believers, out in the diaspora synagogues. When James and Paul intersect in Jerusalem, James says, "Hey, Paul, great to have you here. You know what? We've heard rumors about what you're teaching out there. We don't believe them. We don't believe that's true. But we've heard that you're saying X, Y, and Z, right?" So James knows that there's a problem with the Pauline teaching as it's being transmitted and retold in the diaspora. And I believe that he sends out this encyclical, you know, with a lot of other great teaching attached to it. But I think if there's a reason that motivated him to sit down and say, we got to send a letter to the diaspora, it was to bring a correction to a misunderstanding of Pauline theology. And, you know, I think most scholars would probably agree with that assessment. And we'll look at this later, but it's just beyond coincidence that James is talking about faith versus works, and he uses the same verses that Paul uses in his epistle to the Galatians and his epistle to the Romans, but to come to what seems like the opposite conclusion. Belief is that he's not correcting Paul's teaching, he's correcting the misperception about Paul's teaching. Mm-hmm. All right, so clarifying Paul. All right, just a few closing comments and we'll be done. I want to talk about the place of James in the canon. It was not canonized immediately. It was not accepted by the Western Church for quite a while. It was accepted by the Eastern Church very early on, and Eastern churches in general, Syriac speaking and so forth, because they were looking more to James. But the early church fathers had a lot of trouble with it because they saw it as contradicting Paul. And so that caused them to question the authenticity of the epistle. In addition, it didn't have heavy circulation in the Gentile church early on. It maybe came a little later into circulation in the Gentile church. So it's called one of the contested writings. Almost didn't make the New Testament, was not included in the Muratorian list of canonical books. So we almost lost James, which would have been tragic, really tragic. Then when we get to Martin Luther, he refers to it as an epistle of straw and rallies for it to be removed. So Luther wanted it out. Epistle of straw just means it's junk. Yeah, he meant it's not worth straw. And Luther wanted it out because he saw it as, once again, contradicting Paul. And Luther, of course, was a big fan of Paul. Modern scholars have also questioned James. Modern scholars, more recent scholars, have questioned James on the basis of they feel it's too Jewish to actually be written by a believer. And so the suggestion is that perhaps James was originally just, you know, a piece of Jewish wisdom literature that some Christian scribe came along and said, "Oh, I kind of like this. I'll just say this is from James," and added a few, you know, words, you know, added the name Jesus to it once or twice, and from James, and or something like that. But this is, we see scholarship doing this all the time because they don't accept the intrinsic Jewishness of the original faith. They think of the apostles all as being, you know, woohoo, we're not Jewish anymore. We're not doing Judaism anymore. So someone who's looking at it from a real, genuine historical perspective would say, if it's really from James, if it's authentically from James, I would expect this to be very, very Jewish, and to read like other Jewish literature might read. One scholar who is complaining about it's too Jewish, he says, you know, I have a parallel to every verse of James, I have a parallel in the Talmud. Well, yeah. You know, that's, and so almost, I have a parallel to pretty much everything Yeshua says. I can find a parallel in the Talmud. That's proof of authenticity, not the opposite.
So I think their conclusion is
correct from a Christian perspective. Yes, it's incorrect from a Messianic Jewish perspective.
Definitely the
Marxists.
Right?
Yes.
But we're definitely the minority.
I know we're the minority, but
don't get me wrong, I'm not upset. I agree wholeheartedly. I do think that we stand between two Goliaths.
Yep.
And we're David.
Yeah, I do too. And here's the thing.
You mean we as in Beth Emmanuel?
Yeah, it's just us.
We as in Messianic.
Okay. Not even all of Beth Emmanuel. I think of just us in this room. Yeah. Of course, yeah, we as in Messianics, we as in Messianic Judaism, you know, this is another example, and we haven't even started to study yet. We're looking at it from the outside tonight. We'll start to study it next week, God willing. But this is another example of, you know, why we do what we do, why we believe what we believe. We own this material, you know, I mean, more so than any other segment of Christianity, this fits us hand in glove. And we'll see that, you know, I mean, you know that already from, you all came here tonight because you love James. Mm-hmm. So you know that already. You've read Chofetz Chaim and you've said, wow, James was there, you know, 1800 years earlier, you know, and so on. And we see just like amazing synonymy with even modern Musar writers, Jewish writers, and the wisdom of the Apostle James.